From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. If ever there was a clear path to reparations for the descendants of slaves, it's in compensation for the property of the 272 men and women sold south to save the Jesuit school that became Georgetown University. Thus begins this week's Freedom Rider column at BlackAgendaReport.com by Margaret Kimberly, who went on to write, quote, "The people held on the Jesuit plantations were doomed to be sent into a lower rung of hell than the one they already inhabited," closed quote. We spoke with her about this case and about reparations generally via Skype from New York Thursday.
I had always known that the Jesuit order owned plantations mostly in Maryland in the 1700s and 1800s. But it recently came to light through a series of articles in the New York Times that Georgetown University exists precisely because of the sale of 272 people, men, women, and children, from a Jesuit-owned plantation in Maryland. In 1838, the small school was struggling. They needed to make money, and they sold all of the enslaved people from their plantations to Louisiana. And this is why Georgetown University exists today. And immediately there were calls for Georgetown to do something to acknowledge that this happened. People spoke of a monument, of scholarships for them. And the descendants, by the way, have been located. They kept meticulous records. And the descendants of these people, their great-great-grandchildren, are alive and well, and there are approximately 15,000 people who can prove direct descent from these 272 people. And there have been calls for scholarships for their kids or some sort of way to make things right. But no one has said the most obvious thing, and that is that Georgetown should pay them money. And the issue of reparations is one that has been discussed quite a bit, and what it would look like, and are certain government policies reparations, for example, affirmative action, or is that a form of reparations? But this is a clear-cut case where specific individuals can be tied to an event which calls for monetary compensation. And in my latest Black Agenda Report column, I say that Georgetown University needs to very simply just pay these people. It's a very rich institution. It has an endowment of $1.5 billion, and it could very easily come up with some sort of settlement for these specific individuals. But I seem to be the only one who's actually said that, interestingly.
You know, Georgetown, of course, is one of many of the top educational institutions in the United States. Brown, Harvard. You know, which one do you want to choose? I had a list. mm-hmm. It's a long one, though. UPenn,
yes.
Rutgers, you know, up and down the East Coast, the Ivy League schools, most of the top schools, either their original endowment came from the selling slaves or profits in the slave trade, or from the labor that was stolen from people as slave labor.
Mm-hmm. Well, slavery was, to say it was a big business, is an understatement. I'm just looking to get this fact correct, before the Civil War began, the total value of all enslaved peoples, nearly 4 million people in the country, was worth more than all of America's manufacturing, all the railroads, all the productive capacity of the United States put together. Enslaved people were the largest financial asset of property in the entire country. The only thing worth more than slaves in the American economy was the land itself. So that tells you that anybody who made a lot of money at that time in history made some money from the slave system. people in the North made a lot of money from slaves. I mean, the cotton was sold somewhere, and that's what happened in places like New York, which, you know, quite as it's kept, was business interests were very much pro-Confederate for that reason. So this is, it was inextricably tied to every other industry, to capitalism itself in this country. So any institution or individual who had a great deal of wealth at that time owed some of it to the slave system. And many of these institutions still exist, such as the universities that you name. Apparently it's something that there were other Jesuit schools that were given some of the proceeds of this sale in 1838, and Fordham University here in New York apparently was one of them, and was founded in part through this this one-time sale. So yes, there are many families, many institutions and businesses that are around today because of the system of chattel slavery.
You know, I'm looking at a couple of narratives about some of this, one coming out of Brown, for example, and it details the fact that at a number of the schools like Dartmouth, for example, there's a narrative, a contemporaneous narrative with the construction of the school by the founder, Eleazar Wheelock, of the 8 enslaved people that he brought with him to New Hampshire in 1770. Now, this is, 6 years before, 6 years before 1776. This is New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And how they built the college. And he details the use of these people on the tasks that were used to construct and improve the campus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can walk the campus now and say they built that building, that building, that building. And so I assume that there are things that you can do, details like that, that you can cull from the historical record and tie it like you do with the descendants of those who were sold off to finance Georgetown construction.
Well, yeah, they people kept very meticulous records of their slaves' productivity. In fact, most of the methods of measuring productivity in the workplace are based on plantation owners detailing the productivity of their slaves. So these were fundamentals that were carried over into business practices to this very day. So you can find individual instances such as the one you just mentioned, but systemically, the practice of knowing how productive a particular individual was, how much cotton he or she picked or could be expected to pick, very meticulous records were kept, and it was a management system that the legacy of which follows to this very day. And so it's very interesting. You know, people have a slang term for their job, calling it a slave, and apparently they were more right than they knew. So the U.S. Capitol, the White House, Dartmouth University. We could go on. This the slave system was the very foundation of America's wealth. And people talk about reparations, but unfortunately sometimes in a rather fanciful, make-believe kind of way. But I'm making the case for a very direct payment to people who can, in this case, especially where it's such a clear-cut tie.
Yeah. I mean, you can link that money to the sale of those people's ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And while that is something most of us cannot do, I cannot do that. But it raises the other question about reparations. And, Black Agenda Report, we've talked about the fact that people use this word, but not, unfortunately, with much seriousness. And instead, it is better to talk about a systemic reparation. That is to say, socialism, a protection for everybody, of every class, of every race. that would restore, and nothing can restore, frankly, the stolen wealth unless you're getting a direct check from it. But it would begin to at least to make America whole and bring some justice. So everything from affirmative action to ending mass incarceration to having a real socialist system, not, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know,
social
more
democracy.
Generous Democratic
yeah,
Party, but a true discussion about public ownership of the means of production is something that is something that we should push for a lot of reasons. But I think that should also be seen as a way of bringing reparations.
Yeah, I mean, the primary change that's taken place in the post-slavery period in the United States is that property is no longer held in people, but property is definitely held in the labor of people, which is the part that they were trying to get at by owning the people in the first place. All they've done is right. abandon the responsibility to maintain the, for lack of a better word, and the way they look at it, machinery.
Yeah, so we talk around it in America more. We talk about inequality and widening inequality. Well, that's, you know, and we have a system now where capitalism doesn't even give people the ability to sell their labor. With the decline of, the triumph of finance capital over manufacturing capital, people could at least sell their labor. To living wage work, which you can't even do that anymore. So we have a system now that doesn't feel the need to employ anyone, and it's a sign of a collapse of a kind. But yes, we need to be able to have living wage employment, to have some sense of I don't know, fairness economically. And we've seen that while capitalism did that for certain people for a long period of time, and people could depend on the economic system in order to survive in a way that was more than sufficient to meet their needs, now we don't even have that. And so it's time to start looking at other things. Slavery is, the epitome of capitalism, I suppose you could call it. Where people didn't sell their labor was, and they were literally owned. And we, you know, had some improvement for some decades with a robust capitalist system that gave enough employment to enough people, often enough that they could survive, to now going completely backwards. Where people can't even, or we're lucky to be able to sell our labor at any price at all.
Yeah. You know, I'd like to really swim in that, and instead I'll just have just one question about this. But if you look at the evolution of exploitation, basically from chattel slavery to what followed, which is essentially ownership of the labor, cutting loose the obligation to maintain the workers, and now. The labor, much of it being done by machinery, where the maintenance costs are substantially lower. I'm wondering exactly what future there might be for those of us who are nothing but maintenance to the system at this point, since we can't produce.
Well, in this system, what's our future? It's pretty bleak. It doesn't look like we have one, really. It seems I've been reading a lot lately about the growth in the number of people who are surviving on disability benefits, people who can't work, can't find living wage work, who aren't healthy enough to work. Clinton, a Democrat, lest we forget, almost 20 years ago, essentially got rid of welfare as an entitlement program, so there are fewer and fewer people eligible to even be supported by the system in times of need. So apparently we'll scrape together enough jobs until we reach an age where we can go on disability. And that's pretty bleak. So the increase in that number, it's not really an increase in the ill health of a segment of the population, but it's people who have no other way to survive. And, of course, I predict that they'll find a way to get rid of that or change that. And, of course, it'll be a Democrat who does it, not a Republican. It's always the Republicans dream of doing these things, but it's the Democrats who actually wield the axe and put these things into action.
Yeah.
But that seems to be all we have to look forward in this country is debt peonage and hopefully the ability to survive unwell older people living on the only crumb left that the system gives us.
As an unwell elderly person. you lay out a very specific case with particulars. There are names, people that can be identified behind this and their heirs. But that is a part of a global push that's been gathering some steam for reparations. You had earlier this year Sir Hilary Beckles, who heads the CARICOM Reparations Commission, was lecturing at Oxford on reparations. You also had a member, a member of the Indian Parliament, also in London, saying that people in India likewise were due reparations. And it's like a gathering storm almost on this point. What kind
of response? There's this historical precedent for it. You know, Germany had to pay reparations to Israel.
That's right.
There was a push, and the effort was a phony one, frankly, for Swiss banks to pay reparations to Israel.
Right.
There were very few people, Jews who were victims of the Nazis, who had any money in Swiss banks. I mean, the press made it sound like there were many people who did. Most Holocaust victims were poor people. They didn't have money in Swiss banks, but it was essentially a shakedown of the Swiss banking industry, and they paid up.
Yeah.
So this has happened before. There's a precedent for it. It would be a huge transfer of wealth, but so what? That's what it was in the first place.
Right.
Britain ended slavery in its colonies in the early 1800s, mostly because the system, it didn't work anymore for this minority group to to maintain a majority of people in enslavement, especially after the Haitian revolution. But what they did is they compensated the people who own these plantations, mostly in the Caribbean. So people in the UK now who are very wealthy because 200 years ago the government paid their families to free their slaves.
Like Cameron.
Yes. And so there's a precedent for doing this. And if you do it for one, you can do it for another. I think what matters is you have to have a group of people who are just relentless, as people in Israel were, and who have, frankly, more leverage, political and economic leverage, to get these things done. But I think at the very least, we can point out that reparations are owed across the planet. All of the wealth of Western European countries, the UK, France, Holland, Spain, Portugal, all of them owe money to people who were enslaved and to indigenous people who were exterminated in the colonial project.
Yeah, you have essentially the construction of capitalism in the United States on the backs of slavery here, and the construction of the international imperial order with the original imperial powers and then the successor, the United States, based on essentially the same kinds of conditions in one fashion or another legally.
Yeah, and so there's a legal, moral, and legal claim to be made, and there's precedent for it. But as we've pointed out in Black Agenda Report, what the world needs is equality. The world needs socialism. And that can go a long way towards righting these wrongs that have gone on for so many centuries. And you know, there's only so much justice you're going to get in a system that is fundamentally unjust. You can't bring people back to life. You can't give this freedom to the departed. But it is possible to make the world, current world, more just and equitable. But it has to be a very fundamental change. And it can't be something where you nibble around the edges, or, you know, there may be a case like Georgetown that springs up here or there where there are individuals who can make a claim for money. But for the millions of people who were impacted by this system, what's needed is socialism, true socialism, not a Democrat, not a liberal leftist Democrat, but true socialism.
And finally, just in terms of actualizing this or moving it along in the United States, African-American voters are more than power at the margins. They're a decisive factor in elections in the United States. That's been true and recognized for at least 50 years or better. Is it possible that some groundswell on this issue can project it onto the national electoral stage and make it a requirement for one of the parties to raise, at least rhetorically, which would certainly enhance the cultural understanding of it, and perhaps even have it become a policy platform and even, I don't know how, but policy?
Well, that's an interesting question. Unfortunately, we have, as a group, relied too much on our so-called leadership, who do nothing but lead us over a cliff most of the time. We have elected officials who supposedly represent us, but I can't imagine any of them actually standing up for this. We would have to declare our independence from the Democratic Party. It's one of many reasons why we need to, and then we can make demands that are truly about our self-determination and not about following people from corporately funded civil rights group or from churches or from elected officials. We could demand many, many things, but we have to have a fundamental shift in the way we see ourselves and in the power that we ought to be able to wield instead of following these politicians and other people who are dependent upon the system and therefore unlikely to really call for any fundamental change in it. We have to dump these people. We have to dump the Democratic Party, dump our very notion of leadership that's existed, you know, that very idea that's existed from the days of Booker T. Washington more than 100 years ago. And when we get rid of that, we can talk about the variety of things that we can demand and the power we can wield to do so many different things in this country.
And we close with an election update from Professor Tony Montaro. Tony, welcome back. It's been a little while.
Yes, it's good to be back.
A lot's happened since. Why don't you give us a recap of the last week or so?
Well, I think the big thing is the internal State Department report, investigative report on Hillary Clinton's emails and private server. And, you know, from everything I have gathered, the report established that she was in violation of some fundamental regulations having to do with emails and State Department communications, and so on. But the big thing is that she's been lying about it for some time. And now everybody is awaiting the FBI report of its investigation. I think we're probably looking at the end of her presidential ambitions. This could end her nomination. It is going to force a crisis of unbelievable magnitude upon the Democratic Party elite. They're going to be forced with the choice of either Bernie Sanders, who comes in with a huge number of delegates and a unbelievable mass movement behind him, or the elites attempting to choose someone else like a Joe Biden, maybe, or an Elizabeth Warren, which would force the crisis even deeper rather than resolving it. But I think all of this, her unfavorables and Trump's unfavorables and the unfavorability of the Congress of the United States in polls, the unfavorability of the media, of corporations, of Wall Street. I mean, in other words, Don, what I'm getting at, we're looking at a nation that no matter who wins the presidential election is becoming increasingly ungovernable. That is a crisis, the magnitude of which has never existed in the history of this country.
You know, you mentioned Warren, for example, if they end up trying to insert her into Hillary Clinton's place. And she's been getting some press lately. She's beaten up on Trump as well, almost like it's a dress rehearsal.
Yes.
You know, you have the issue of the economy front and center, being pushed there by the people behind Trump and the people behind Sanders. And Clinton, of course, almost tone deaf. She was talking about Trump with the foreclosures, the remark he made when he was a private citizen in the real estate business that, yeah, there's going to be a crash and, hey, I can make some money. Saying that he's wedded to the policies of the past, but actually the mortgage crisis came out of the, among other things, particularly the repeal of Glass-Steagall by Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress. Warren has sort of liberal credentials on the economy, no actual record, but that, you know, she doesn't have Clinton's record to her benefit. Do you think that the shifting of all of this, maybe even the release of these materials now, could be because they recognize that the economy, the election is going to be decided on the economy and they got to get their person in there?
I don't know that it's that intentional. I just don't see who among them or what groups among them could manufacture all of this. I mean, these are events that emerge from a system in existential crisis. Right. And by that, I'm talking about both the economic and the political system, right, but in particular, the political system. And it's out of control. The Democrats were looking to nominate the least credible candidate of all of the possibilities they may have had. And you know, this whole email thing and her becoming Secretary of State as a kind of a compromise with the Obama campaign in 2008, you know, to get her support. I mean, she's appointed Secretary of State because that's high profile. And it was the beginning of her campaign for 2016. Right. If Obama, you know, won a second term. So she was going to use that position. And therefore, she needed as much secrecy, as much opaqueness as possible. And then, of course, how this private server, email server, is connected, and these emails are connected to the Clinton Foundation, which now it is becoming clear is itself a criminal enterprise. And if you needed no other evidence of it, it's the role of the Clinton Foundation and the Clintons, both Hillary and Bill, in Haiti, and all of the millions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars, that were solicited for the rebuilding of Haiti and houses and so on and so forth. But in fact, there's been no accounting of most of that money. So she was running for the presidency from the Secretary of State's position. And the corruption that is now being uncovered is connected to that. But nonetheless, the Clintons are so powerful among Democratic Party elites that the deals had been cut years ago. And although she was possibly the worst of all candidates with the most baggage, the support of strategic individuals and groups within that party had been cut, and they went with it. And now they're reaping the whirlwind. And this is a good thing, because the Clintons will ultimately bring the Democratic Party to its knees.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.